It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A handful of conversations to end this week on Friday. A little bit later in the program, I'll talk with Congresswoman Cindy Axne of Iowa's 3rd District. The U.S. House reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act this week. We'll talk about it with her. She's a co-sponsor. Also wrote an amendment, authored an amendment to that reauthorization. Also, Chief Justice Mark Cady, I'll talk with him about the passing of former Iowa Supreme Court Justice Daryl Hecht, all to come. But first, let's get an update of highlights from our Iowa lawmaking body, the legislature. Joining us to do that, James Lynch, politics and government reporter for the Gazette. Hi, James.
Hi, Ben.
We want to point out this is a significant week, the so-called second funnel of the Iowa legislature. This is, if I've got it right, any non-appropriations bill that passed in one chamber that does not clear a committee in the other chamber is officially dead for this General Assembly, right?
With a caveat that until they adjourn sine die, everything can come back to life in one form or another. But yes, that's the simple explanation, Ben.
Okay, let's talk about the status of a few bills that some legislation that we've been hearing about in our news. Felon voting. This was a priority for Governor Reynolds. What is its status?
Well, it was a setback for the governor. This passed the House 95-2. Nearly unanimous. It got over to the Senate, and the Senate Judiciary Committee didn't have the votes to approve it yesterday. And its future is unclear. It sounds like it probably won't see any more action until next year. But the hang-up is not so much the concept of restoring felons' voting rights, but which felons and what do they have to do to become eligible to have their voting rights restored? And I think that's where the real argument is going to be and what will determine whether or not this constitutional amendment will get sent to the voters.
Traffic cameras. Bring us up to date on that saga.
Again.
I guess the Senate has been trying to ban them for years now. What's the latest development?
Yes, this is at least the seventh year that the legislature has debated traffic cameras. And for the third year in a row, the Senate has voted to ban them. Now, over in the House, they've taken a different approach. They want to regulate the cameras where they can be. They have to, if a city wants a camera, they have to demonstrate to the DOT that it's needed for safety, public safety purposes. There would have to be signage to warn motorists that there are cameras. And the House proposal calls for the state to take 60% of the revenue from the cameras, which would be about $6.5 million a year based on current citations, and they would put that into a state public safety fund. Now, some senators have indicated they could go along with that because they think if they take 60% of the revenue, the cities might say, nah, the cameras aren't worth it. Mm-hmm. And so it would be as effective as a ban.
Right. I wonder, your opinion, if this is a matter of the way you've laid it out there, if this is a matter of really public safety as pertaining to traffic cameras or what I'll just say, revenue envy that these cities are getting, like Cedar Rapids, has raked in millions in past years, haven't they?
Yeah. And that's part of the problem. The argument from some lawmakers is, look, it doesn't matter whether you're from Cedar Rapids or not. If you go through Cedar Rapids and get a citation, you pay this fine. But if you live in Des Moines or Pocahontas, you don't get any benefit from that. So by scooping some of the revenue and putting it into a state public safety fund, everybody would benefit from those citations. Cities with the cameras say that's sort of hypocritical, saying, look, these cameras are bad. We don't want cameras used, but as long as you pay us, you can keep them.
Right. And the other interesting aspect here, quickly, just to mention, is that when you have a traffic camera, you can deploy your officers in other places. They don't sit in cars with radars, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And most of the cities with cameras are using the funds for public safety purposes.
Let's talk about public land acquisition. There's a bill pertaining to that. Remind us what that is about.
This is sort of a sleeper issue. I don't think anybody expected it to be as controversial as it has become. But the bill that passed the Senate and came out of a House committee would restrict who can use a state revolving loan fund to buy property for water quality projects. And it the Farm Bureau and the Iowa Cattlemen are the only groups who have registered in support of this bill. There's a couple dozen, three dozen groups from the Natural Heritage Foundation to hunting groups to conservation groups opposed to this. And basically, the target seems to be the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation to prevent them from borrowing the money, buying land, and then either selling it or giving it to, say, a county conservation board or the Department of Natural Resources. And the argument for this bill is that it's a matter of fairness that you have a group like the Natural Heritage Foundation borrowing state money and then bidding against a private landowner or farmer to buy land. And I think it probably will pass the House, but this has really become much more controversial than anyone suspected.
Okay. Surviving the second funnel, though, we'll watch it. James, the so-called personhood bill, this is what, a bill that would criminalize the consensual termination of a pregnancy. Also, a very nuanced bill. Explain it a little bit. Where is it at?
It's dead for this session. This started out as a bill to add penalties for the non-consensual termination of a pregnancy. If a pregnant woman was assaulted and she and the fetus were killed, there would be additional criminal penalties. If she was killed in a car accident and the fetus was killed, there would be additional penalties. Then it was amended in the Senate to change the wording from termination of a pregnancy to unborn person. And abortion rights supporters said, whoa, now it's a personhood bill, and the bipartisan support disappeared. And when it got over to the House leaders just said, we don't want to have an abortion debate. That wasn't our intent with this bill. And so they aren't going to take it up.
Mm-hmm. And to be clear, I might have misspoken there. This is to do with the non-consensual termination of a pregnancy.
Right, right.
Exactly. Let's talk about a controversial election bill we've been hearing about that would make changes to our election process here in Iowa. Some additions include closing of polls earlier, the signature verification for mail-in ballots, also this add-on to require college students to turn in a form before graduating, indicating whether they plan to stay in Iowa.
Right, right. This bill, its future is, I guess I would say, cloudy. The House has passed a bill that was very narrow in its focus. It dealt with a situation up in the Winnesee County area where some mail-in absentee ballots weren't counted. And the House bill would have set up a system to track mail-in ballots. The Senate had this 40, 50-page election bill, and they amended it so that it became the House bill. I don't know what interest the House has in that broad election bill. So it's alive for consideration, but it probably is going to be a challenge to get it out of the Senate. And like I said, I don't know how much interest there is in the House in taking up such a broad election bill after they passed an election bill just a couple of years ago.
A few more minutes with James Lynch, politics and government reporter for the Gazette, running down some of the highlights out of the Iowa legislature in this past week. This end of this week marks the second funnel, a deadline to get out of both committees in both houses in order to advance, with some caveats there, as James earlier explained there. We've been talking about medical marijuana and that law evolving. The latest evolution of medical marijuana in Iowa, what is the status there? And remind us what that's about.
Well, the House passed a bill that modestly increased the availability of medical marijuana for people with a variety of conditions. It got over to the Senate, where they've typically wanted to move farther and faster than the House, and they made it more restrictive in committee. So the bill is still alive, but House members who had been working on this bill expressed disappointment yesterday that the Senate made it more restrictive. So I'm not sure how that's going to end up. There's quite a bit of support, Ben, for increasing the availability of medical marijuana. It's one of those where it's how fast do you go, and I obviously there's not agreement on that right now. So we'll have to keep watching that throughout the session.
Of course, this is not happening in a vacuum across the country. Medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, now legalized in a number of states, also a state here in the Midwest. So I don't know if you have any sense of whether that influences debate, that the country is swinging, the pendulum, so to speak, is swinging really toward fewer limitations on marijuana generally.
Yeah, and you hear lawmakers talking about they don't want recreational marijuana, and that's not being considered. But they're afraid that, you know, it's the camel's nose under the tent, I guess, that if they approve medical marijuana use, then the next step is recreational marijuana. So that does enter into it. On the other hand, as lawmakers look around and see what other states are doing, I think they're learning from that they're, you know, the medical marijuana aspect, they're learning from what other states are doing. So it kind of works both ways.
And finally, James, in the 1 minute that we have remaining, I wonder if you can tell us about the status of an Iowa Senate bill that specifies cases where workers are to be denied unemployment benefits.
I haven't tracked that real closely, Ben, but there's some concern. They wanted to make it very clear some grounds for termination of an employee, if there are hostile employee. Of course, the kind of the other side of that is, you know, what you say is hostile, I say is just somebody who wants to promote a union.
Right.
So I haven't heard any discussion in the House on that. We'll have to watch that one to see if it comes over to the House and they want to take it up. I mean, the Republican-controlled legislature generally has been willing to sort of take a stricter approach to labor laws, but I'm not sure that one is on their agenda this year.
Okay, James Lynch, the end of a very busy week at the Iowa legislature. We thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thank you, Ben.
James Lynch is the politics and government reporter for the Gazette, and I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the U.S. House of Representatives reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act. The act provides funding and grants for a variety of programs that tackle domestic abuse. The reauthorized act added some new provisions that restrict gun ownership, also expanding transgender rights. Now, the vote was 263 to 158, 33 Republicans, joining all but one Democrat to pass this measure in the U.S. House. U.S. Congresswoman Cindy Axne of Iowa's 3rd District was a co-sponsor of the reauthorization of the act and also an author of an amendment to the act. I spoke with her yesterday. Congresswoman Axne, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Ben. Great to be here.
This act goes way back to the 1990s, first signed into law by President Bill Clinton. It's been reauthorized, changed over the years. Generally speaking, remind us what it covers and why it's so important.
Well, you know, the Violence Against Women Act expired on September 30th of 2018, and as you mentioned, it's been in place for quite some time. It was a landmark bill that really helped women in particular, of course, but any victims of violence have the resources that they need to make sure that we can address the issues that they're facing from a long-term perspective, certainly try to push back against the all-too-common violence that we're seeing against women and victims in general, and of course make sure that we are looking at all of those elements that are involved with protecting women, whether it's local law enforcement, attorney general's offices, local prosecutors, those types of things, that they've got the right tools in place and resources to make sure that we can protect women.
Now, I understand the House went into this, the House under Democratic control, of course. It intended it to be a bipartisan bill, but we had only one Republican co-sponsor, and as I mentioned, 33 Republicans joining in the vote. Why didn't more of your Republican colleagues in the House join you?
Well, you know, really this went back to a provision that they wanted to see in place that that did not get passed, a motion to recommit that was not included in the bill. And my belief is that that is why they decided not to sign on. You know, I think that it's really unfortunate that we're seeing issues that like this become politically partisan. To me, violence against women, sexual violence against people in general, is something that should be a nonpartisan issue.
Mm-hmm. I understand also the Republican hesitancy or no vote in this case by many in the House Republican Party were these new provisions to lower the criminal threshold to bar someone from buying a gun to include misdemeanor convictions of domestic abuse or stalking as well. The current law that expired, as you pointed out, applies to felony convictions. Was that a stumbling block for Republican colleagues?
Yes. Well, you know, as a matter of fact, you know, they would like to see an opportunity for certain persons who I believe should not have access to a firearm have access to a firearm. And so that was the stumbling block that we were running up against.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about also another provision called the so-called boyfriend loophole. This expands existing firearms prohibitions to include dating partners convicted of abuse or stalking charges. Why should that be part of this?
Well, I don't think it requires having a ring on your finger to make sure that that you're protected. And so anybody who is a victim of, you know, violent crimes, and in particular, you know, violence against women with this act, should be protected. It shouldn't matter if you have a marriage license. You know, if you're a boyfriend, you know, or live-in partner, you need to be held as accountable. And that's something that I will always stand behind.
Now, the National Rifle Association, the NRA, called for a no vote on this reauthorization that passed the U.S. House. It, I understand, notified offices there, perhaps yours, perhaps not, because they thought you would be a yes vote, of course, but to some key Republicans, I'm sure, that they were scoring how lawmakers would vote on the bill to measure future ratings and endorsements in elections. Let me put forth the arguments in the words of the NRA spokeswoman, this is Jennifer Baker, to have you respond to their arguments. She says, on behalf of the NRA, that the gun control lobby and anti-gun politicians are intentionally politicizing the Violence Against Women Act as a smokescreen to push their gun control agenda. End quote. Larger than that is the idea that gun rights activists, they claim, say these new provisions are too low of a threshold to deny someone a constitutional right for the rest of their life. Congresswoman Axne, respond to those claims.
Well, you know, let me just go back to a quote here from Des Moines Police Department Chief Dana Wingert. You know, the appropriations pertaining to the Violence Against Women Act are truly important and impactful on many fronts, and that the Des Moines Police Department embraces a victim's first approach to dealing with violent crime, and with a special emphasis on crimes that involve women and children as victims. Many years ago, they established a domestic abuse response team to ensure all factions of the family were provided the necessary attention and services needed when these types of incidents occurred. But unfortunately, it goes without saying, the vast majority of those women are being those being served are women. We've got a problem here. The head of the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Elizabeth Barnhill, of course, our Des Moines Police Department, they all believe that we need to address this issue. This should never come down to political partisanship. We have victims within everybody's own backyard. This is not a socioeconomic issue. This is not an issue of one area of the state or the country over another that doesn't deal with this. This is everywhere. And anything that we can do to stop the attacks on women and provide them the resources to live successful lives after an attack, and to also give those involved who can help women with these issues, should be there. I will always stand by the fact that there's no excuse for not supporting an effort to help curtail violence against women.
Mm-hmm. I want to point out the White House says it supports a clean, what it calls a clean extension of the Violence Against Women Act. But let me have you tell us about an amendment that you authored to this act that increases grant funding for the for certain instances. Tell us what your amendment does.
Yeah, so the amendment was adopted. I introduced an amendment that increases STOP grants to help local law enforcement agencies and community organizations better combat and prosecute than the violence against women. So they basically provide prosecutors with proper tools and resources they need to get justice for survivors and prosecute those who commit violence against women. It ensures that our local police officers, our sheriffs, our local law enforcement have greater opportunity for the resources they need to be successful. You know, when I was running in this race and to get out here to help Iowans, I had an opportunity to sit down with our local Des Moines police force, and at any given point in time, they are woefully understaffed, you know, out on the beat because they are consistently being asked to do more with less. This gives them the opportunity to address an issue that we're seeing across this country and provide the resources to back it up. That's what they need, not people who are going to take away the resources that they so desperately need in an ever-increasing role that deals with so many additional elements, whether it's issues like this, whether it's mental health issues. They're always being asked to do more with less, and this bill will address that.
Congresswoman Axne, in the couple minutes we have left, I have a couple more quick questions. Now, of course, the Senate has to deal with this reauthorization. It has not yet advanced, I understand, its own reauthorization of Violence Against Women Act. By the way, Senators Joni Ernst of Iowa, of course, and Dianne Feinstein of California are working on it. Do you think the gun provisions in the House bill can clear the Senate?
Well, that's, we'll have to, I'm not making any predictions on that, unfortunately. I certainly hope that it does. I'm encouraged, of course, to see that our own Senator Ernst is trying to work on that. I know that she personally understands that this is an issue. I'm hoping that, again, we can all work together in a bipartisan fashion and make sure that we protect women across this country.
Mm-hmm. The White House, as I said, says it supports what it calls a clean extension of this act. I understand President Trump has not yet weighed in on whether he would sign it if it reaches his desk with these gun or transgender provisions in it. Do you know otherwise? Has the president given his view on what would be acceptable to sign into law?
Well, we have yet to really get some fine details on what his opinion would be now that we've passed the bill on all of, you know, the fronts that we've been able to put forth, all the additional amendments. Of course, there were quite a few of them. So it's hard for me to tell at this point where he sits on that because there have been so many amendments that were added to address the multiple issues that we're facing.
U.S. Congresswoman Cindy Axne of Iowa's 3rd District. It's the NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, back in just a moment.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, former Iowa Supreme Court Justice Darrell Hecht died. He was 66 years old, and he'd been battling skin cancer. Hecht served on Iowa's highest court for more than a decade, from 2006 until the end of 2018. That's when he resigned while receiving treatment for melanoma. Joining us to remember Darrell Hecht is Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady. Justice Cady, thank you for making time for us.
You're welcome, Ben.
So sorry for the loss of your colleague and, I understand, a good friend. You served with Darrell Hecht for the entirety of his career on the Supreme Court. How will you most remember him?
Yeah, well, thank you, Ben. Our court family is certainly saddened by his loss, and our hearts go out to his family. Justice Hecht was appointed to the court in 2016, and I did have the honor of serving with him until his retirement last December. I know I have so many thoughts and reflections on him, but what I remember most is just what a thoughtful person he was. He was always so kind and genuine. He was measured in his words, but so genteel and respectful to others. At the same time, he was generous with praise and compliments, and sometimes he'd just call me out of the blue to offer a suggestion of help or to tell me that everything was going well. So he was just a real kind and genuine man and a real legal giant.
Mm-hmm.
He was a champion of the little guy and the person who had less and those that have been injured and aggrieved in life. He was very thoughtful of others.
What would you look to as some of the most significant rulings that Justice Hecht was involved in?
Yeah, well, you know, he was part of a court that made some important and significant contributions to the development of our law, not only in Iowa, but across the nation. He was involved in a series of cases dealing with procedural fairness and in sentencing of children, the development of workers' compensation rights for Iowans, important cases in the area of tort law and the development of our law in the areas of the duty of care and foreseeability, procedural fairness in the prosecution of criminal cases. And, of course, he was a part of Iowa's equality marriage decision 10 years ago.
Right. That announcement, we celebrated the 10th anniversary of the Varnum decision. It was an announcement that came, well, the anniversary came on the same day as we heard about Justice Hecht's death. What did that Varnum decision mean to him? This is a ruling in Iowa, made it the third state in the nation to legalize same-sex marriage, coming 6 years before the U.S. Supreme Court said same-sex marriage was legally recognized in all 50 states. What did the Varnum decision mean to him? How did it fit into his jurisprudence?
Well, it's like all the other work that Darrell did. He saw everyone as equal, and he sought to lift up those who were not treated equally. But Justice Hecht's legacy is far more than just any one case. Every case that he participated in affected Iowans, and he knew that, and he put everything he had into every one of those cases. And so, Ben, I think in the end his legacy will be defined by his qualities as a judge, his impartiality, his deep and true commitment to justice, and his genuine thoughtfulness in everything he did. And I can't help but think, too, that his legacy will extend to his family, who he adored who adored him.
Mm-hmm. In what ways do you think younger legal minds, just starting off as you and Justice Hecht were many years ago, might look to Justice Hecht as a role model?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting reflection, because it seems like oftentimes we tend to be divided and disputed, and Justice Hecht showed us how we can address issues and reach results and find common ground and interact with each other in respectful ways. And so I think that if younger Iowans are looking for someone that might show the way to our future, I think Justice Hecht's life and the way he lived his life and the way he interacted with others is a really good example.
Chief Justice Cady, you were not only a good colleague for many years with Justice Hecht, but you were also a good friend of his, I understand.
Correct.
Talk about him outside the court. Please, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's many things that come to mind. You know, Darrell was had an outstanding voice, and he would share that voice and song with us from time to time. I can remember it was last summer or the summer before where he opened an Iowa Cubs baseball game by doing the national anthem. And my daughter-in-law sent me a picture yesterday of he attended my son and our daughter-in-law's wedding several years ago, and it was a picture of Daryl dancing, and he and Sandy danced through the night, and it was just such an enjoyable reflection to see the joy on his face. And he was just such a genuine person, we often laughed around our building because I think on a time or two, he enjoyed the popcorn, and he would cook it in the microwave, but there was a time or two when he forgot to take it out on time and started a fire in the microwave that brought the police to our building. So there's a lot of nice memories about Daryl, and it's fun to think about those.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, he was just he just really cast a huge shadow, not only in our state but across the nation. He gained a national reputation in civil justice reform. He served on the National Commission, was appointed by the Conference of Chief Justices to help shape the civil justice reform across our country. And he oversaw the development of the business courts in Iowa that are doing so well today. And he oversaw the admissions of new lawyers and also the discipline of lawyers within our court system.
You mentioned that the Iowa Supreme Court is in mourning this week. How are you marking the passing of Justice Hecht?
Well, we've established that we've all put our memorial. We have a memorial on our webpage, and we've all contributed. The seven of the justices have contributed to that, and we have opened it up for others to do the same. And we're also, just as a Supreme Court, we're collecting our thoughts individually and recording them in a way that they'll be collected and given to his family. And then next Saturday morning, we'll be having a memorial service in our building in his honor. So today, this afternoon, we have the investiture of Justice Christopher McDonald, who we're replacing Justice Hecht. And so I'm sure there'll be some thoughts expressed at that time as well.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Chief Justice Cady, to share with us some reflections about your former colleague and your friend. Justice Daryl Hecht of the Iowa Supreme Court died this week at the age of 66. He'd been battling skin cancer. Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady, thank you so much for spending some time with us so that we can get a better idea of the great person that passed from our midst this week.
You're welcome, Ben. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Misfitting. Disability Broadly Considered. That's the title of an Obermann Humanities Symposium that started yesterday and continues through tomorrow, April 4th through the 6th, to be held at the Iowa City Public Library, also Merge in downtown Iowa City. It's bringing together leading disability scholars from a diverse set of disciplines to discuss the relevance and the importance of disability in these fields. Tricia Zabrowski is with us, co-chair of the symposium. She is Professor Emerita in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at the University of Iowa, joins me in the Iowa City studio. Now, Tricia, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
Let's talk about this title, Misfitting Disability Broadly Considered. Why this topic and why now? What are you looking at?
Well, disability studies is a relatively new field.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, the borders are very pliable. In the past 10 or 15 years, what we've seen is more and more humanities scholars from very diverse fields, as you said, are pitching their tents here and taking a look around. And What we've seen is a great collaboration or great collaborations between people from art and music and theater and sociology, and merging with disability rights activists as well as practitioners in healthcare. So it seems like this is a good time now to sort of stick a pin in it and see where we are.
Sticking a pin in it. I think you did that with the title Misfitting Misfit. That's a bit fraught, isn't it?
It's very fraught. And actually, my co-director, Doug Baton from the Department of History, and I talked a lot about what we wanted the title to be, and he actually pulled from a paper written by our keynote speaker yesterday, Rosemarie Garland Thompson. And what she did is she sort of reframed disability as misfitting in time and space, and that all of us either do misfit now in some way or will at some point in time in our lives, not only in a static way, but across time, if you think about the way the body and the mind are sustained by the built or the natural environment, right? So at one point in a day, you might fit very well your mind and your body with the environment where you find yourself, built or natural. The next 15 minutes, there's a mismatch. So that's why we say misfitting broadly considered. And that, you know, that it you go in and out of this space. Everyone does.
Right. And it's interesting, the keynote address, which you mentioned the speaker there a moment ago, talk about that. That's fascinating because that's really into the humanities and a theme everyone knows.
That's right. And so Rosemarie Garland Thompson is... She is in the English department at Emory, and she also is going through right now a program in bioethics. And she has taken Andrew Solomon's work, and he wrote Far From the Tree, which is this great book. He was on campus, actually, a year ago, talking about families into which different children are born and how the unit sort of deals with that or navigates that. So she used that as a lens for looking at this new ballet, Frankenstein. And so she has framed Frankenstein, the monster, the creature, as being like a child born into a family that can't sustain him.
He is the ultimate misfit.
The ultimate misfit, and how... At first, the monster, the creature, tries to connect and then is rebuffed and then takes revenge. And then she also talks about the pas de deux and how that is like the dance that families do. It was really fascinating talk. And so that's one way that art, literature, dance can or has shown the influence of disability.
It's so interesting that you're taking disability to include all of us when we've separated ourselves from disability, what we used to call being handicapped. But in your definition, we should all be able to understand what it means to be disabled, to be a misfit, and to empathize with that. I remember a few years ago, this has to be 10 years ago, that on this program I interviewed a young man born without legs. And I thought it was going to be a conversation about being disabled in this society and how difficult it was to get around. And he very clearly educated me that he wasn't disabled. We were disabled in the way that we spoke about him, and that was hard for him. But he could get around just fine. He'd never had legs.
Right.
In fact, they'd tried to fit him with prosthetic legs, and they didn't work for him. But he could maneuver around New York City. He could go all kinds of places, and he felt just fine.
And I think that point as well that you just described is also very controversial. So some folks—
What part of that is controversial?
Some folks who are in the disability community will say, you will never— if you do not have a physical disability, or if you do not have a cognitive disability or a speech disability, whatever the classic, to use the term, disabilities are, you can never understand. So if you're neurotypical, you will never be able to understand my experience. And I think that's a valid point. I think, however, the experience of not being sustained in the natural or the built world, to some extent, is one we all can relate to.
We have just a minute or two left. I wanted to mention, of course, that for over 20 years, you have directed UI Speaks for Teens. It's a summer residential program for adolescents who stutter. Your research emphasis has been in stuttering over the years. Give us an update on that and where we are in terms of stuttering and intervention with stuttering.
I think that this, we are now at a place where we recognize that there's nothing wrong with stuttering. That in a way, it seems like it's fitting, well, it is fitting very well into this narrative that we've just talked about, right? That it's all about can the environment and your own constitution sustain this way of communicating? And so my research is looking actually at how teenagers who stutter come to change the way they think so that they become ready to do something about stuttering, whatever that is. Could be therapy, could be just learning how to talk with other people about it. So it's broadening what therapy really is.
Okay, before we go, Tricia, so many fascinating aspects we haven't talked about, including the ones that we have talked about. For those interested, this is a free symposium. Tell us how people could get in on the last day or two of this symposium. How do we find out more information?
So the website is misfittingsymposium.com. That has the complete schedule. I would like to say, come on down to the Iowa Memorial Union tonight at 8 o'clock and see Nina G, a comedian who stutters, and there'll be a couple of other stand-up comedians with disabilities performing, and it's going to be a great show.
Okay. Also, if you want to find out more information, find your favorite search engine. Just put in Misfitting Symposium. You will find it directly there. Tricia Zabrowski, co-chair of this symposium, fascinating professor emerita in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at the University of Iowa. Tricia, nice to see you again.
Okay. Nice to see you too. Thanks, Ben.
And it's the end of our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's check in with Mark Sinnott, Iowa Public Radio Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing well. You're going to groove us into the weekend with what?
Yes, indeed. A brand new release just came in from Los Angeles-based singer-songwriter Natalie Mehring, who performs and records as Wise Blood. And she has a brand new record called Titanic Rising. And what strikes me about this record is, with all the different kinds of music out there these days, this particular album really seems to be based on, and is in fact based on, the time-honored classic pop songwriting structures and production that some of us may recall from the 1960s and 70s. So it's kind of refreshing to hear this classic approach to music. A lot of great songs here from Wise Blood, and this one's called Something to Believe.
A lot of coffee today. Got lost in the fray. I gave all I had for a time. Then by some strange design, I got a case of the empties. The ruler of my world, a lost, forgotten pearl.
Of Wise Blood, Something to Believe. Mark Simmet, we have a little bit more time for a second number. What do you want to
Okay, well,
us?
How about another classic-leaning performer? Tyler Ramsey is his name. Just like the introspective singer-songwriters of the 1970s is what I was thinking when this one came out. For the Morning is his new album. He used to be in Band of Horses. He's had a solo career for a few years now. Tyler Ramsey, and this is The Bottom of the Sea.
First sign of time.
singer-songwriter from Asheville, North Carolina, Tyler Ramsey, to groove us into the weekend. Mark Simmet of Iowa Public Radio Studio One. Tracks, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Groove into your weekend in style. Thanks for joining us, and talk to you again on Monday. You never thought you'd